This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, why is there never a happy ending? And other questions writers get asked.
So this week we're obviously going back to one of our questions asked sort of formats, which are nice and relaxed, because I think we've been covering some fairly big subjects recently.
Yeah, certainly things that have been quite writing focused and quite in depth in terms of, you know, taking apart character motivations and things. So this is kind of a, over the year, Madeleine and I will get asked these questions, sometimes more than once. And this is a chance to say these are the most popular questions, or the ones that really struck us as the oddest questions.
Yes.
And we'll get to answer them. And, you know, presumably if it's a question that you've been thinking but haven't got around to asking us, you'll have an answer. Or maybe it's something that you're wondering about for your own work.
Yes.
So
We should also say that this is not us taking the mick out of people who do ask these questions. It's more that these questions get asked so much that we thought that we'd actually do an episode where we're answering them collectively. So please don't think we're mocking you if you've asked us this question or you've wanted to ask us this question. That's not it at all. These are just the most frequently asked questions.
Yeah, definitely.
So, do we want to start by answering the question in the title?
That was very much one that was directed at me. Was there never a happy ending? I have to say, this is one that I haven't really been asked for a while, I think because I've been providing more happy endings, even though quite often they tend towards being more bittersweet than just proper happy endings.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly with I Belong to the Earth out and with a bunch of short stories I wrote around that same time and some other work within the Random Writers, which is my writing group, there was one person in particular who's like, yeah, I knew it wasn't going to be a happy ending because you don't write happy endings. It's like, no, I really can. I can, I promise. It's like, yeah, but you don't want to, do you? There's some reason you just don't want to. And it wasn't until the novella Amy's Academicals came out where I finally sort of gave it to this person to read and said, there you go, see, I can write a happy ending without a qualifier on it.
See, so, that's nice.
Yeah.
I appreciate that because I am a massive sucker for happy endings myself. I think
I like them,
that
but
life is just full of sad moments and so it's quite nice to have happy endings. But by God, do I tend to fill my books with misery.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, I think maybe this is partly to do with my illustrious forebear Thomas Hardy, who puts his characters through hell and then gives them a horrible ending, and I'm kind of that I've got to put them through hell. They can't have a happy ending unless it's really, really been earned.
Yeah, I mean,
but I don't hang them at the end of it. I don't put them through hell, give them the glimpse of happiness on the horizon and then hang them.
Yeah, but
usually.
Usually. But who knows? I mean, that question was one of the reasons that I actually ended up writing the Hamartia cycle.
Yeah.
And obviously, you know, I've told this story before. My mother sort of taking me to the sign going, for God's sake, please, can't you write something happy? And I was like, eh. She's like, please, can you not write anything which, you know, something which doesn't have any, you know, blood and death and war and misery in it? And I was like, I mean, and she's like, you know, why don't you write something nice, like, I don't know, with fairies or something. And, you know, she was very much thinking of the flower fairy collection I had when I was little, and you know, this is the woman who used to write out the little fairy notes and leave them in bushes for me and stuff like that, you know, that kind of thing. That's what she was channeling, and I was like, write about fairies. So I did. She got her wish, technically.
Just like you do with the folk.
But she realized very quickly that fairies are really horrible, and she just gave me like a blank card to do whatever I wanted. And I did. So, you know, I'm actually quite thankful for this question of why can't you ever write a happy ending? But I must admit, I am still a sucker for happy endings, which is hard to believe for anyone who's read either of it, well, has read The Sons of Bestien or Blood of the Delphi.
Because I'm like, we're all like suspending disbelief at this point, Madeline, because none of us have read the ending yet. So I'm like, really? You really like happy endings? Are you sure about that?
Yeah. No, the third book should have a happy ending. But, you know, like, these things change. So maybe when I get to it, it won't be happy. Who knows? But actually, the whole reason that that it became a series was because I realised the ending for book one and went, no, that's too sad. I have to rectify this.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I will say that... I'm not saying this question is unjust for me, by the way, because and a lot of these short stories are ones that, you know, this was pre us being friends, so you wouldn't have read them necessarily. And I looking back at them now, I don't necessarily think they're that great because I was kind of learning the craft. But they did tend to lean towards the bleak, ending-wise.
Mm.
And, you know, so it was a fair question in that respect. I feel it wasn't entirely fair with the Unveiled series because... I was like, well, everything kind of got resolved happily at the end of I Belong to the Earth, except the romantic subplot. And it was the same with I Am the Silence. I'm like, yeah, again, except the romantic subplot, everything kind of got resolved. So if you were someone who was a romance reader first and were really invested in that romantic subplot, then yeah, you probably weren't getting quite what you wanted.
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think in terms of happy ending, you just don't know how to give a couple a happy ending. And I speak from the position of reading through your Harker and Blackthorn series, and what, we're on book 6 now, and I am still waiting for my ship to sail, and oh god, are you really, you're really, really making this painful for me.
It's look, honestly, it's painful for me too. I had no idea it was going to be this bad. you keep getting little flickers of hope, don't you? I do as well, in fairness.
Yeah, yeah. Every now and again, it feels like there's a sort of they're inching closer towards each other, and then every now and again they inch a little bit closer, and then they take a huge stride back. And I just want to shake them.
It is all in character, though. I will say that much.
It is, yeah. No, it's not being done just for the sake of torture. No.
In fairness, I would also have to say of the Unveiled novellas and short stories and things, it, considering within the context of a novella, it took Grace the entire novella to get to the point where she was willing to admit she had any feelings for somebody. And okay, admittedly, Amy was working out her sexuality at the time, so slightly different kettle of fish again, but yeah, they don't get together in chapter 2. I don't do that, I'm afraid. So, you know, if you're going to get invested in one of my romantic subplots, you're going to have a bit of a wait, guys. Sorry.
That's not to say it isn't worth it.
Even with The King's Knight, in fairness, which, you know, I wasn't really writing from a romance perspective at all, though. It was just historical.
Yeah.
But even there, it was a case of not until the last 3 pages do you get any glimmer of hope.
Yeah. I mean, also even in the King's Knight books that no one else has read, except for me.
The ones written specifically for you.
Specifically written for me. You really drew that one out as well. In fact, you drew them all out. You're an awful person. But yes. Okay, so that's our first question then. Jules, would you like to pitch a question that you frequently get asked?
Yeah, I think this is one that every writer gets asked, and I've certainly been asked it recently, very specifically by one of my library volunteers prior to second lockdown, and she didn't realise I was a writer, and she said something, and I was like, well, actually, I kind of disagree with that. And then I said, well, you know, I do write, I'm published, I'm with, you know, these guys and these guys, etc., and I write this. And she was really, really interested, and it turns out, you know, she'd quite like to write herself. You know, she came up with some of these other questions as well, which I've also been asked by other people. But this is basically, where do you get your ideas from? And this is kind of a two-parter, but yeah, everybody gets, I think everyone who writes gets asked this at some point. And the very simple answer, which isn't helpful at all, is most of us don't really know. Not in a concrete way. We can't say this is how you get an idea. You're either somebody who looks at something and sees a lamp, or you're someone who looks at a lamp and says, what if it was sentient and, you know, had come down on a spaceship and was, you know, plotting to take over the Earth, kind of thing. And it's only recently sort of come to me that there are some people who genuinely, you know, they enjoy stories and things, but they genuinely don't have any actual imagination, which seems awful. And that's not an insult, that's just a, you know, their brain works in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting thing about inspiration, which is that a lot of people think that it's just this thing that materializes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And that's not true. It can feel like it because often, you know, there are things in our subconscious which can trigger it, but it doesn't appear out of nowhere. And just like everything else, you can exercise your brain so that inspiration just comes much more easily. And one of the things that I've found with especially people who are starting out with writing is that there's this whole idea of writers lounging around going, oh, I cannot get inspiration, oh, woe is me. And it's just, being a professional writer, that doesn't fly, because you cannot just wait for inspiration to strike in order to write. You have to be able to write at any time. You have to be able to trigger your own inspiration. And there are exercises, as I said, that you can do, which can help to kind of train your mind up so that you are just inspired constantly, because you've got these questions filtering through your head. And the what if is a big one, or how does, or I wonder, you know, all of these things, which means that you find inspiration even in something that you might have found boring. So it comes to the point now that if someone said to me, I want you to write a story about such and such, I'd be able to find inspiration. And certainly, Jules, I mean, you've had experience with this because you got commissioned to do The King's Knight, and you found the angle in which you wanted to tell the story.
Yeah, very definitely. And I was given quite a loose set of parameters. It was my idea to go with that period of history. The publishers felt that they could sell that period of history, and they turned out to be right, which is good. And they said, you know, this is who we want the main character to be. They didn't give me a character sheet or anything. They just said it needs to be like this. So I was kind of like, well, okay, that could potentially be your very typical noble knight, honest and true kind of thing, which seems quite boring to me, or I could make them the complete antithesis to what we believe the code of chivalry is, without getting into what chivalry really is. And then the more I dug into the history around it, and the complicated political setup, and things like the injustices of serfdom, and and things like that, the more I was kind of like, I need somebody who can straddle the divide between the rich and the poor here as well. So it was all sort of layered up like that, and it was a very definite and quite deliberate process. And then after a certain point, the character just took off and told me things, which was great. And you know you've got something when it does that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So yeah, you've basically got to be able to sort of bring things to life in your own way and to have a process in order to do that. That being said, there are instances where you're just walking along, you're just doing something, and inspiration strikes like lightning, and you have no idea where it's come from. All you know is that all the gears in your head have hit a particular point and everything has aligned, and suddenly there is this idea. And it can come in all sorts of forms. And I mean, it comes in dreams. One of my, the YA book that I actually submitted for my dissertation, my master's dissertation, it came from a dream. I just dreamt about it. I just dreamt about the opening circumstance and woke up and went, that is amazing. I've got to write that. So I did. So it can happen in dreams. It can also happen if you're reading a book and you get this great vibe and you just think, oh, I feel so inspired. I want to write something in this period, or I want to write something which is, you know, in this genre, or with this kind of narrative voice. That's all possible as well. But the point is that there's no one place or no one process which allows you to get inspiration. You manufacture it on your own.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And sometimes it can come out of, you know, being interested in things. I'm a terrible one for this interests me and this interests me and this thing interests me, and that's three disparate things, and yet I'm going to get them all to work in a book together. And somehow I usually do as well. It's like, I think is my friend Catherine Hetzel, who is a children's author. Mm-hmm. She does this workshop for children where when she does an author event, she'll have, you know, basically this cloth bag, mm-hmm. and she'll go around and she'll get three different children to pick an object out of the bag, and then with those three objects the children have to come up with a story each, which, you know, somehow connects the three objects.
That's
and
cool.
I sometimes think that's kind of how I look at the world. It's like, oh, that's caught my attention, that's shiny, I like that, I'm having it, kind of thing.
It's like, you're like, I like this, I like this, I like this. I'm going to put them all in a box and rattle them together until they mix.
Yeah, it's basically Schrodinger's story for me. It is a story and it both isn't a story. And that all makes it sound quite fun and twee, but I think there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes subconsciously as well. Mm. As in, I will, if I'm... This will sound mad, but if I'm stuck on getting something to fit, I will think about it for 5 minutes as I go to sleep.
Yeah.
And it's not that it then gets solved in my dreams, but my subconscious is busy working away on it while I'm sleeping, which is quite convenient time-wise. And then quite often an answer will pop up at some point over the next couple of days.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you can't work your way around something, and I'm getting a bit off topic here, but thinking about it while you're doing something else, something mindless like housework, or when you're going for a run, or you're at the mm-hmm. gym, or whatever you're doing, baking a cake, can quite often help your mind get over any hurdles. Because I think sometimes when we try and think too focused away with our conscious mind, our frontal lobes, sometimes that actually, we kind of get in our own way.
Yeah, absolutely. And the subconscious is an amazing thing. It does continue to tick over while we are, you know, going about our business, which is how dreams work. It's your subconscious sorting through all of the information that you've taken in during the day. Which is very funny in some ways, because it means you lie down, you dream the most random things, and you're like, what have I been thinking about?
Yeah, definitely. There was a big international incident regarding socks the other night in my dream. We're talking like Brexit level proportions about the availability of black socks, which is both disturbing and mundane at the same time. And obviously the world
socks?
Was ending. No,
the world
we're
is
only talking about
ending
utilitarian. That's my point. My backdrop for my dreamscape is that the world is ending. There's usually a tsunami coming or a zombie apocalypse or something. That's usually there in the background no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely.
My head is not a fun place to be.
I had a dream about Nazi-occupied France the other day, where I was a schoolgirl with my two sisters in a sort of a convent school in the mountains in France, and the Nazis arrived and took over and were using it as a base camp, and we had to, you know, we were working against them, but at the same time had to sort of pretend to be all pally-pally with them because they used us as servants. in yeah. order to survive, so that I had to do that so that my sisters wouldn't get killed. And I have no idea where this came from, except it might have been because I was actually thinking about my great-grandmother that day, who, again, was part of the resistance in France, and she used to hide the resistance in her house. And in order to stop the Nazis finding them and killing all of them, she would pretend to be friends with the Nazi officers and give them eggs and things like that, in order to sort of hide the people who were fighting against it. So I think maybe that's where it came from, but it was very strange.
Yeah, I mean, some of the vivid ones are the ones that sort of really hook you. I wouldn't say that dreams are necessarily the place to get an entire plot from, but you can definitely get facets from them.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, dreams are a really good way of just getting a concept or characters sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's... I'll go on to the other... Because this question that came to the fore was basically this person who asked me, where do you get your ideas? It was like, she loves writing and she, you know, can write well, but she has trouble coming up with ideas. You know, so it is, there's lots of different ways of doing it. It's personal to you as a person. The thing is to read widely and watch lots of things and look at what other people are doing, go for walks, pay attention to the world, kind of thing. Because you're not going to create anything unless you're filling up the well with interesting stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, she also said, how do you get into writing? And I'm like, part of me thinks that's a darling way of putting it. And I don't mean that in a patronising way, but part of me is like, it's not really like joining the stock market. It's like, you can get into it with a piece of paper and a pen, you know? Yeah. It doesn't have to be fancy.
Yeah, I think there's also, you know, some people who feel like, oh, I don't want to really start writing because they feel like they don't have the confidence to do it. They don't have the confidence to give it a go because they think they need to be trained up before they can start. And that's the thing about writing. The only way you can train up to write is to write.
Yeah, the first thing you write is not going to be the next great British novel, probably.
Well, it might be.
But it's unlikely. Playing the averages, looking at the statistics, probably not. It's probably going to be a little bit of microfiction.
Yeah.
It might not even be a bit of fiction. It might just be a character sort of expose.
Yeah.
Or it might be a 500 words to a prompt. And believe me, when you start writing, 500 words seems like a lot.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
It's one of those classic, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. How do you write a book? Well, one paragraph at a time, one word at a time. You break it down into a chunk that's actually manageable for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, if you want to write, just write. And that's the thing that frustrates me is when people say, oh, you know, I'd write a book if I had time. Time is not a part of it.
Time's not the problem. If you wanted to do it, you would find the time for it.
Yeah.
And sometimes there may be constraints on your time, but you would find 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there. One of my friends who wrote the magnificent and quite harrowing, but also very funny book, Home,
mm-hmm.
Which came out 2 years ago now, I think,
mm-hmm.
has been, you know, she's had a dreadful couple of years in the sense of her, I think he's 9-year-old son,
mm-hmm.
Turned out to have a spinal tumour. And, you know, he had all these operations and he had chemo and everything else. And because it pressed on his spine, he couldn't walk for a long time.
Mm.
And then it went into remission. And then she found out again, sort of midway through this year, that it, you know, it's come back again. Mm. And yet through all of this, she has still managed to write. Sometimes it might be a sentence a day. Sometimes it might be several pages. But what she thinks about is keeping the chain. So she'll have like this planner on the wall with the days of the week on or what have you. And every time she manages to write something, she, you know, crosses out a day. And you get a chain of days where you've managed to write something. And her point is that if you really want to write, you can write anywhere under any circumstances, no matter what is happening, no matter how traumatic. And this isn't to shame anybody. This is just to say that time really genuinely doesn't come into it.
Now, I can also appreciate that some people say, well, I want to write a book, but I'm going to wait until I'm retired or something like that. That's fair enough.
That's fine. That's your choice. That's not the same as saying, oh, I wish I had all your free time. Like, we're happy-go-lucky little, little folk who just don't have to hold down jobs and run households.
do everything else. Stuff. Yeah, I mean, this is not the period where gentlemen who didn't have to do anything could just idly spend their time writing. You know, we do have jobs.
Yes.
And writing is a job. That's the other thing. Is, you know, for some people, writing is a hobby, and that's absolutely fine. But for others, writing is a job, and it is hard work. So, you know, just saying, well, I wish I kind of had the time. Don't say that. It's really insulting, actually.
I think that's the thing, is it's quite often said in a patronising way as well. Yeah. I wish I had the time. I'd do it if I had the time. I'm like, I think you'd find that you had 5 minutes a day where you could jot something down if you wanted to.
Yeah.
The thing is, you don't really want to, for whatever reason.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so on to the next question, and this is a technical one. And I'm not actually sure how many times maybe Jules has been asked this, but this is something I get asked a lot, particularly by students and stuff like that, is how do you write dialogue?
Yeah, I have been asked that. I mean, obviously I don't have students, so no, but I'm less likely to get asked in that technical way, but yes, I have been asked that a few times.
Yeah. And in fact, I get asked this so much, I literally just put together a lecture on it.
Yeah.
Which includes just a very long list of different ways of saying hello. This is what my students have to put up with. But I thought I'd actually address this. How do you write dialogue? And it's something that I really personally enjoy. I love writing dialogue. In fact, if I can get away with it, I will just have long streams of dialogue. And then I'm like, oh yeah, I need to actually put some stuff between this. And then I have to cut it down. But I do love dialogue. And I think dialogue is incredibly important because in our day-to-day lives, dialogue is the way in which we communicate most of our ideas. It's also how we learn about one another. You know, almost everything that I know about other people has been gained through some form of dialogue, either with them or with other people.
Yeah, in writing terms, dialogue is incredibly important for character as well. It can tell you a lot about their background, it can tell you about their socioeconomic status, it can tell you about their heritage, perhaps, as well. It can tell you what their overall general mood is, or, you know, what their general disposition is.
Yeah, it can also tell you what their relationship is with the person they're speaking to.
Yeah, definitely. And dialogue is important. You know, even for readers who don't really care that much about dialogue, it is important. The minute you start listening to audiobooks, if the author has kind of fluffed the dialogue, it's flat. It doesn't matter how talented the audio narrator is. You know, the dialogue is flat, it's not engaging, and, you know, there's no real noticeable difference between any of the characters. So yeah, dialogue's a tricky one, but when you get it, when it finally clicks for you, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So how do you write dialogue? Well, there's basically lots of ways in which you can get better at writing dialogue. One of the things to do is actually just get everything down and then rework it, and one thing I love to do is just read it all out loud, actually have the conversation. And yes, my family think I'm crazy, but that's okay because I enjoy writing dialogue. And if they can hear me having very loud and passionate conversations with myself in my bedroom, they have learnt just to leave me alone. But it does make a difference. Another trick that I've learned, and this is actually really, really effective if you've got lots and lots of characters who are from lots of different backgrounds and things like that. And if you're struggling to kind of get in your head exactly what they maybe sound like or how they speak, a really good thing to do is pick an actor or a, you know, a person or a character who has maybe a similar regional dialect or a similar kind of background, similar sort of attitude, things like that, and to watch videos of them speaking. Listen to the way they speak, get their voice and their tone in your head, and then use their voice as a jump, you know, as a jumping block to kind of shape the voice of your character. This can actually mean that you suddenly start only hearing this person's voice for your character, which I don't think personally is a problem. But it actually really, really is a nice way of suddenly being able to differentiate between voices. And even the subtlest of changes that come along with that does make a big difference in the overall dialogue and the overall conversation. So there's a little trick for you if you're struggling to kind of get your character's voice in your head.
In fact, before you start worrying about voices, worry about listening to other people.
Yeah.
I think this is not a skill that is lauded enough. And it can be listen, you know, eavesdrop when you're on the bus or when you're in a shop or whatever. Listen to the cadences and rhythms of speech.
Yeah.
Start letting them filter in. You don't have to listen aggressively and take notes or anything.
Yeah, don't be weird about it.
Yeah, try not to be weird. Don't be the weird person who's loitering behind them with their hands in their pockets, potentially doing something in their trousers or anything. Just actually listen. Listen to the radio. Listen, you know, pay attention to how dialogue is done on, you know, decent sort of screenplays and things.
Mm.
I would say don't worry about dialogue too much in things like soap operas, because generally it's not very good for a very good reason. It's not intended to be.
Yeah.
But when you see something that engages you, make notes to yourself of why it engages you.
Yeah. And also the nice thing to do is if you are kind of writing, for instance, say you're writing historical stuff, read things from that period. Watch things which are based in that period, which have, you know,
got
good reviews. Yeah, which have been done well, basically. But yeah, so like, for instance, if I'm sort of writing kind of Georgian era, I might read some Jane Austen. I might watch the BBC version of Pride and Prejudice. Really, it's any excuse.
Yeah. Not that you need an excuse for that one.
No, I don't. I don't need an excuse. I will just watch it whenever and, you know, just wherever I can. So, yeah. So that's a good way of kind of getting these things into your head.
Okay. So one that I do get relatively often, and that I'm always at a little bit of a loss to answer in a satisfactory manner. What made you want to be a writer? Like, the honest answer there is, I don't know. I don't think it wasn't so much that I thought, wow, I'm going to sit here and this is what I want to do with my life. This is a case of, I kind of have to. Mm-hmm. I feel compelled. I'm not trying to make this sound like a vocation either, because it's really not that romantic. It is just a case of, no, I have to. I have all these stories I have to tell.
Mm. Yeah. See, for me, because I was in a similar position where I was just constantly telling stories and making up stories. But for me, there was a very conscious decision where I suddenly went, oh my God, I can be a writer. Which had never really come into my mind, because I really struggled with reading. Obviously, I've mentioned when I was little, because of my dyslexia and stuff like that, and because I wasn't really able to engage with books, and we didn't really get to watch that much TV, I told myself a lot of stories. And for me, that was just sort of a coping mechanism. That was just how I whiled away the time. And it was great fun. I really, really enjoyed it. But then Caroline Lawrence, who was the author of the Roman mystery books, and I'm sure I've told this story before, I really loved her books. My mother gave me, the first one I read was actually the second in the series, The Secrets of Vesuvius, which my mother had read and then she lent to me. And I fell in love with these books. I was really into sort of the Romans at the time anyway, and obviously mythology and all that jazz, and mystery books. So I really, really enjoyed these books. And then she came and visited our school. And she was there talking to us about writing and her process. And it was like a light bulb went off in my head where I suddenly went, oh my God, wait, you mean I'm like, you can do this for a living? Because I'd just been sort of telling stories and I just thought, yeah, that's just a thing you do. And then I suddenly went, oh my God, this is like, no, this is a job. This is something you can actually get paid for. And I just knew from that moment that I wanted to be a writer. And that was that. I owe her so much. She's just brilliant. And I really do recommend her books. Fantastic children's books. Very well researched as well. So big tick there. And yeah, so that was the moment for me. And I've never looked back.
I think I was about nine, probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was when my spelling was recognisable as English. And I've been telling stories before that. I was the one when we played games as kids who would come up with the idea of what our game was about.
Mm.
So, yeah, there's the story aspect, but there's also the language aspect, because I was just in love with words, and, you know, I still am. It's been an intense relationship. An intense plus 40-year relationship, and we're still going very strong, thank you. And not just in one language, we like to switch.
Oh, yeah. So,
so there was that aspect as well. I think that's probably a particular nerdy type thing, because I don't think every writer just kind of loves words just for their own sake. It's kind of like, that's a medium. That would be like saying all swimmers love water. You know, some of them do, and some of them are just kind of like, no, the water gets me where I need to go.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, one I do get a lot, and from other writers, is how do you write so fast?
You're so annoying!
I get that a lot too. I would like to say that part of this group I'm a member of, one of the writers in it writes, you know, she writes sort of contemporary romance, and she has just finished her 15th book this year. So I would, you know, 15th book since the beginning of lockdown. Admittedly, she writes full time.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a full time job and I write. So I basically have two jobs. And yeah, maybe I would get, I'm still not sure I'd get through 15 books a year if I did this full time. Genuinely not sure. But in fairness, I've done six so far this year.
You have. And you've done six so far this year. Writing, and I don't mean part-time, but you're still, you know, you're still working at the same time.
So yeah, okay, I'll try and answer the question. The thing is, I'm not really sure, because some of it has to be the compulsion to get the story down, because I need it down. And I will say quite honestly that some of this is craft and learning. I wrote the first draft of I Belong to the Earth in 3.5 weeks, and then I rewrote it 12 times.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say this, and I know I've said it before, what other writers seem to hear is, she wrote her first book in 3.5 weeks and got it published. And like, yeah, but you're missing the year and a half in between I took to go back over it and over it and over it and polishing it. And I still don't think it's my best book. I'm hoping that I've never written my best book, but I look back at it now and think, oh, I could have done that better.
Hmm.
So it's not like I'm ashamed of it or anything. It's just a case of, with what I know now, I think I could do better. But you probably should think that as a writer. The craft and production element of it, I rewrite every single book now 3 times.
Mm.
But each rewrite doesn't go as deep as... It doesn't have to go as deep as it did before. So, I care about the quality of what I've put out, obviously. But I'm much closer on my first draft to how the book will eventually look.
Yeah.
Than I used to be. Whereas if you take something like I Am the Silence, it's like, oh my God, that was a complete mess. It was like this tangled knot of spaghetti. I was trying to pull apart with two carding combs, and everything was falling apart, and there was sauce going everywhere, and it was just really bad. So the more you write, the faster you'll get. And the faster you get, the better the quality of what you write generally will come out, because you're doing more writing. So it becomes a sort of positive feedback loop.
Yeah.
That said, different genres require different things. I'm writing urban fantasy, and that is, for me, very quick. Historical fiction takes slightly longer.
Mm.
So technically I only wrote 5 books last year and they weren't as long. And if we're talking epic fantasy, well, that could take years because there's a lot of world building and things. So it's down to, you know, what you're interested in, what you're engaged in, and what genre you're writing in as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It does make a difference. And as you say, Jules, practice. You continue to write. If you write lots, then you get quicker. Believe it or not, I'm actually considered to be quite a quick writer myself, though you wouldn't recognise that on account of the fact that certain books have not been published. And in my defence, that's because I've had to write other things, which people don't get to see because it's been for academic work instead. Also, epic fantasy's hard.
Epic fantasy is hard. I mean, I've got on the back burner an epic fantasy series where I'll pick it up occasionally and poke it a little bit and think, yeah, I do like the characters. I do want to work with this. But, you know, I've kind of been doing that for about 15 years with it. So,
yeah.
Either its day has not come yet or it's not quite the right book yet. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And also, of course, you know, different people have, you know, different processes and how they do it. For some people, they really like to edit as they go. For some people, they like to get everything down, then go back and edit. For some people, it's a mixture of the two. Some people struggle a little bit with words and with writing and reading and things like that, which, again, is fair enough. And even though, you know, we did say, you know, if you earlier on we were talking about the fact that if you really want to write, you will find the time to write. Finding the time to write, but actually, you know, that doesn't mean that necessarily you're going to be writing things very, very quickly. Finding the time to write means that you give yourself time to write, but that might only be a little bit of time, which means that you're writing all the time, with all the time that you have, but that just takes a little bit longer, which is why I think that someone who's writing full time can probably produce a lot more work. But also, yes, if you're like Jules and are very, very quick, you can produce several very good books.
I think
all in a short period of time.
I think there's kind of a vital capacity thing as well, whereas some people can, I can now, I think, sit at something and write with short breaks for between 6 and 8 hours, if I was ever given that amount of time. I'm never given that amount of time to do it.
No.
But other people are kind of like, well, 4 hours spaced out throughout the day, and that's me. That's my working day for writing done. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's just how you work. In terms of practical for getting faster, some writers talk about using dictation to get the first draft down. I've tried this with certain short stories and things. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more editing involved. And I think you have to train your brain to say the words that you would normally write down. So if you're someone who thinks with your fingers kind of thing while you're typing, then that's quite an adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I'd like to do more of, but, you know, I'm a bit sort of wary of losing the immediacy, because I think there's a tactile sense there. You know, you're touching the keys of the keyboard and somehow that's stimulating the words that are coming out.
Yeah.
I know that doesn't make any logical sense, but that's how it seems to work for me. It
makes complete sense.
So yeah, you can try that. Why not? Try a program like Dragon, naturally speaking. You might find it works for you.
Yeah.
The other thing you can do to train yourself to just go faster, you can learn to be a better typist. I've never done this. I'm a terrible typist. I sound like a small herd of elephants going across the keyboard. And my little fingers don't get in on the action at all. I'm self-taught to type, and I type badly, so let's be clear on that.
Also, your hands are tiny, so...
Look, my hands are fine. Okay, they are very small, but they still manage to span a keyboard, honestly. Get grief. Make it sound like I'm a borrower or something.
I mean...
writing with a needle. You can try things like writing sprints. So you set a timer for, I don't know, 5 minutes. And in that 5 minutes, you're just going to write. And you're not going to think, you're not going to edit, you're not going to go back and think about your word choice. You're just going to go for 5 minutes. And then you take a break. And then you'll try again. And perhaps you'll do this for half an hour. Mm. And eventually, you'll get past the point where you're self-censoring and self-editing, and you'll be able to do a full half hour in one go, or a full hour.
Yeah.
I mean, doing this worked wonders for me and got me to the point where I can average 5,000 words a day quite easily.
Yeah. Yeah. So there we go. Okay, so now I'm going to address a question which annoys me just a tiny bit, and it's meant really well. But when people find out that I am an author, what they often will ask me is, can I find your book in the bookstore, or will you have written anything that I'd have heard of?
Would I have heard of you? The thing is, if you speak to 99% of authors, 99.9% probably of authors, would I have heard of you? The answer is going to be no, even if you're a well-respected household midlister. Unless somebody reads in that genre, they won't have heard of you.
Yeah.
Or unless they work in a bookshop or a library or something.
Yeah. And I cannot begin to stress how many books there are in the world. Like, loads. Even before you even start to count, you know, self-published books, there are a lot. Now, technically, yes, you can buy the Hamartia Cycle through a bookstore. And there are bookstores where it is actually on the shelf, so that's nice. But bookstore shelves will tend to, you know, have books which are guaranteed to be sellers and new releases, and that's about it. They have a really limited amount of space, and obviously they've got to be very cautious with all of their stock. So no, the chances of you actually finding something which is just sort of a bit of a mid-lister, unless it's just immediately been released and then it's being sort of put out there and you pick it up, are very slim. The other thing you have to think about is that bookstores don't get their books straight from the publishers. They get them through a distributor. There's two major ones in the UK. The one I use is Gardner's. Now, Gardner's basically will take 50%. So they buy my books. So basically, when I sell them a book, they will take 50%, and then through that, they kind of distribute it onwards. So they might distribute it onwards, so they make a profit, and obviously the bookstore will then sort of, the Gardner's will keep maybe about 20%, the bookstore will take the other 30% or whatever, something along those lines. Now, whenever you get to bookstores, like the particularly the WH Smiths in airports and things like that, or particularly in supermarkets when you see books listed, almost always those books which have been listed are actually kind of put up with, you know, 80% discount, which means that Gardner's get it at 80% and they kind of get redistributed there. So the authors themselves are making incredibly small amounts, like pence, for each of those books being sold. And the only reason it's possible is because loads and loads of those books have been printed. That just isn't possible for small time and particularly niche publishers. So you can do it for kind of general things which you know are going to sell well. Chick lit, things like that. Again, nothing wrong with that. There's sort of a guaranteed sell, particularly airports and stuff like that. Crime, similar kind of thing. But for fantasy, which is really, really, you know, niche in terms of some people will like some things, some people will like other things. Fantasy does... It's a niche within a niche. Some things do sell well,
niche
but
within niche.
You're not guaranteed the same thing. So only big publishers can do it. Smaller publishers can't risk it. And obviously now a lot of books which, and you know, this isn't just self-published, but smaller publishers as well, use print-on-demand services, which, to be honest, are a better kind of financial arrangement for everybody, more guaranteed, and it just means that a book is created as and when it's wanted, so that no one is left with these huge stocks of money.
These huge stocks of books which end up getting remaindered or pulped.
Exactly.
So from an environmental point of view, it's actually better as well.
Yeah. And the problem with that is that most of the kind of the distribution services, which you can do that, and again, you can still get these things sort of available through gardeners and stuff like that. It's a lot more of a ball ache, to be honest. And a lot of the services where you can do it sort of will kind of tend to really, you know, be quite exclusive. For instance, you know, Amazon does an amazing print-on-demand service, but that does mean that, you know, everything does come through Amazon. Even if someone else buys it, it's coming through Amazon. So bookstores are not going to put it on their shelves because unless they vamp up the price, they won't make any money from it. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And I think the other thing you need to think about, not you personally, but obviously everyone else, with when you're talking about the books that turn up in supermarkets, that's on the back of a huge, huge marketing push from the publishers.
Mm.
And they won't put that kind of clout and money behind something that they're not reasonably sure they can get the investment back on. It's a business.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's the same, you know, getting books in, say, Waterstones or Barnes & Noble, where you get the big displays of books on counters or books front-facing. Every single one of those things is paid for.
Yeah.
I know they're saying that, oh, they don't pay for it in Waterstones anymore. Now it's staff choice. But actually, I'm 90% sure that's not entirely true.
Mm.
So these are all things that you would pay for. Indie authors probably don't have the money to spend on that. And that's not the best form of advertising for them anyway. So why would they?
Yeah.
So 90% of book sales happen outside of bookshops now.
Yeah. And even if you do order things through bookshops, you know, as I said, you can order my books through bookshops, but they won't be on the shelves. It's very, very unlikely for them to be on the shelves. And it's very, very unlikely for a book which was published a while ago, unless it's a big seller, to actually be on the shelves either. I cannot begin to stress again how many billions of books there are out there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not possible for them to all be on the shelves. So when you ask, you know, is it something I'd know or can I find your book in a bookstore? Technically, yes. But also, if you were going to be able to find someone's book in a bookstore, usually it means that they are a fairly heavy hitter in terms of the publishing world.
Or you've specifically gone looking for them.
Yes.
Okay, so off the back of that one, here is a can of worms question. What can you earn as a writer? Can you earn a living? Or, the most insultingly phrased, what do you earn?
Yeah. No, this is just something that always kind of is a bit sort of makes gobsmacking, is the creatives who will get asked, you know, how much do you earn? Like, you don't ask random people how much they earn. It's one thing for friends or, you know, to be in a conversation and that to sort of come up naturally. It's another thing entirely to go, oh, you're a writer. How much do you earn? Like, you don't ask that.
And it's artists and actors and things too. And what this boils down to on the most insulting iteration of this question is the person asking it is usually asking for validation that their choice not to pursue a creative career is in fact validated by the fact that the creative in question may not be making a living wage at that moment in time.
Yeah.
And that's insulting. That's a passive aggressive way of saying your choices were the wrong choices. And I do get to feel superior, even though perhaps I hate my 9-to-5 office job and I would rather actually be writing.
Yeah. There's also this...
we see you, okay? We know exactly what's going on in there.
There's also this idea that, and it's this completely misguided idea that sort of applies to pretty much most jobs, which is that skill actually represents how much you get paid. This is obviously not the case. There are so many examples of this. But if they go, okay, so what do you earn? Well, they're not earning that much, so they can't actually be that good. Is this just really insulting? Because it doesn't take into account the fact that, you know, well, just for example, we've talked about literary fiction. It gets all these prizes and stuff like that. Literary fiction sells very badly.
Yeah, it is actually one of the most niche markets.
It is.
So tackling the other part of this question, mm-hmm. can you earn a living wage? Yes, you absolutely can. Yeah. Can you earn a living wage through traditional publishing? Probably not if you were published first after 2010, because the market has changed so drastically.
Yeah.
If you want to earn a living wage and get the sort of clout where you can negotiate decent advances and things from a big publisher, at some point you're probably going to need to indie publish.
Yeah.
And you should probably do it anyway. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Keep as many of your rights as you can. In some cases, keep all your rights and keep creative control of certain things.
Yeah.
It doesn't preclude you from then working with a publisher in future, or an agent, or whatever.
Yeah.
The people I know who are making really good money from writing are almost all entirely indie published. And I'm not talking about people who are writing erotica or just writing romance or whatever. A lot of them are writing in very niche genres, so they're supplying an underserved genre. So, for example, one person I know writes Egyptian ancient history, and it was incredibly popular and took off. And you know, she's not working with an agent, but she's had loads of other historical fiction published via quite big name publishers.
Mm.
And there's someone writing crime and mystery and urban fantasy and things like that. So you absolutely can make a living wage doing it. There is a tipping point, and you're unlikely to do it writing one or two books. You're probably looking at needing to write about 20.
Yeah.
So if that puts you off, you maybe need to think about whether writing books is the way you want to make money. You can absolutely write books for other reasons.
Yeah. But yeah, it's been a massive point of contention within the writing community, and you know, the Society of Writers have sort of been pushing against this, and I mean, even Philip Pullman has kind of added his voice to this, basically saying that this is not sustainable, and that the way that things have changed is too much. You know, it should be that writers can make a living wage from traditional publishing. That is the way that it was sort of operated to be. But then this is not exactly something which is exclusive to writing, because the living wage, just in general, is no longer a living wage across the board. So there does need to be a fundamental shift. But that doesn't mean, as Jules has just demonstrated and explained, that you cannot actually make a living from writing. What I would recommend is, anyone who does want to make a living from writing, is don't just quit your job straight away and get writing. Get a kind of like a, you know, a backlist of stuff, get established, start working, and then, you know, you can make that kind of decision. But don't assume that it's going to be easy. You could end up writing a lot of books before any of them kind of get picked up or take off, and none of them, you know, might never take off. It might always just be sort of, right, a few sales here, a few sales there, kind of all adds up. So it's something to be conscious of. This is not an easy profession.
Yeah. And honestly, the people who are making a living out of traditional publishing have all been published before 2010. So that's 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got to be a bit more... You've got to understand the market a little bit. You can't just fling a book out there and think, well, that's it. I'm 40 grand a year for the rest of my life. It's not going to happen. You also need to become an expert in things like marketing.
Yeah.
Or keeping in touch with your own target audience. So, I mean, we've covered this in other podcast episodes, but so we won't go into it. But just to say that you cannot leave all that up to your publisher, even. Not anymore.
No. And also getting one massive advance, you know, you might hit the jackpot and get a great advance. That is not likely to be a regular thing.
Yeah, we've discussed the horror stories around that before as well. So check out some of our previous episodes. But yeah, basically, yes, you absolutely can. It's a bit of a hustle to start with. You're going to have to work very hard, and you're going to have to hold down another job as well.
Yeah.
Because unless you've got a very supportive partner who's just like, no, you go and be creative, darling, I'll pay for everything.
Yeah. And again, great if you do. Perhaps you're retired, something like that. Just be advised that it's very unlikely you'll be making the big bucks from the get-go.
Yeah.
But if you do, okay, good for you. So, okay, all right. So this is actually the last question that I've got listed down for mine. And this is one I do get asked semi-frequently, which is, can you read my book?
Ooh.
Yeah. This is one where, actually, I know that I was guilty of this when I was starting out writing, where I want other writers to kind of mentor me a little bit to read my work, so I can understand this desire. Hell, I was probably, well, I was one of these people, so I completely get that. Looking at it from the other side now, I can understand why it's a problem, and on a very personal level, I write, that doesn't mean that I read very fast. I mean, I can read an okay sort of pace, as Jules will tell me. Jules says,
see, she says she doesn't read fast, but I'm like, okay, here's book 5 of Hargrim Blackthorn, and then 2 days later it's like, finish.
Yeah, but that's
book 6.
That's because I literally don't do anything else, Jules. I literally just spend 24 hours reading it.
I feel like such an enabler.
You are an enabler. I'm just like, I'm supposed to be doing other things, but no, like, I've not cooked, I've not done any of the housework, I've just sat and read. So reading takes a while for me. And this is the other thing. I work at a university. I read through a lot of students' work. This is a job that I get paid for. And there are people out there who do get paid to read through your work. Now, it is fantastic if you find a mentor who is willing to put in that time, but if writers all read all of the stuff they ever got sent, they'd never have any other time to do anything else. And it also devalues the, you know, the effort and the time and the experience that comes with actually critiquing a piece of work. Now, once again, I am very fortunate because I'm surrounded by some exceptional writers, such as Jules, who, if I send my work to them and say, please read, Jules will read it.
Yes.
And get back to me. And I also have, I have Amelia as well, who, fantastic, really, really good at critiquing stuff as well. And so I'm very fortunate in that sense. But honestly, the best possible thing you can do if you want your work to be critiqued is to join a writing group.
Yes. And learn to critique someone else's in return. That's the thing. You can't just rock up and say, someone read my book, and then not expect to give anything back. Mm. And honestly, you'll learn a lot more about writing if you actually do some critiquing.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, the can you read my book thing. Generally, that's going to be a no for me, just because it's a time constraint. Mm. If we have built up a relationship, as in that, you know, I know you, and, you know, I'm kind of interested in the sort of things you might like to write anyway. Believe mm-hmm. me, you don't want me as a beta reader unless I'm vaguely interested in what you write, because I'd be no use to you. And that goes for any other beta reader as well, to be honest. You don't want somebody who really only likes hard legal drama reading your cozy romance mystery. It's just not...
Yeah.
It just doesn't really work. The thing is, I want to give back and I want to help, but I don't think I can do that in most cases by reading someone I don't know or have no experience of their book.
Yeah.
It's just not going to work. Having said that, if you ever want to contact me for writing advice or publishing advice or advice regarding contract law, in terms of, I'm not a legal professional, but I can point you in the right direction,
mm-hmm.
and I can certainly tell you what things you need to look out for, mm-hmm. and what things you might want to draw people's attention to, then yeah, absolutely, email me. I will get back to you. I will 100% always reply to those, because I do want to help. I know how difficult it is. I want to be holding a hand out to help the next person up behind me.
Yeah.
I just can't do it by necessarily reading your work unless we have a pre-existing, you know, we've established a pre-existing relationship, etc.
Yeah, absolutely.
For one thing, it's really awkward if I'm writing something and it turns out that you've had a very similar idea, because if I then publish my book, does it look like I've nicked your stuff,
mm-hmm.
kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, there's also the fact that, you know, we might, you know, I might really, really like you, but I might just not enjoy your book. And that, you know, that's possible. I have family members and friends who have not enjoyed The Sons of Bastion. And I don't begrudge them that. I don't think that they love me any less because they haven't enjoyed my book. That's just kind of the way it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can, it just might not gel with that, with me as a reader. And, you know, at that point, because time is so limited, I am very selective about what I read, incredibly selective about what I read. So yeah, it's a really difficult one, but I do honestly feel like one of the reasons that we have this podcast is because we do want to address things and maybe answer some questions for people who do want to write or just want some reassurance, who are curious, you know, about the whole process works. So
yeah, in part, this is our way of giving back. We don't charge for it. We don't take on advertising or anything like that. You can download it for free and not be bombarded with adverts for things you don't want and won't buy. yes, we enjoy doing it, obviously. It's a labour of love. And we like to talk about our own work as well, which is also fun. But ultimately, this is also a way of giving back. So,
yeah.
Okay, my final one.
Mm-hmm.
What is the weirdest thing about being published? Yeah, I'm rephrasing this question. I've been asked lots of different things about what it's like being published.
Mm.
But they kind of all boil down to, what's the strangest thing about being published? There's lots of strange things. For me, I think possibly the strangest thing is the amount of fan mail I get. I still can't wrap my head around it. It's
so nice.
It's lovely. It is absolutely lovely. I will admit that I will always reply to the first piece of fan mail I get from somebody because I appreciate it so much. Someone has enjoyed something I've written so much that they've written to me to tell me they've enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. That's amazing. Part of me immediately goes into imposter syndrome mode.
Yeah.
And I don't want people to stop writing to me because I love hearing from you. I really do. But part of me goes into, oh my god, they've read my book. They know what a fraud I am. So yeah, that sort of cognitive dissonance between those two states, the Red Dwarf confidence and paranoia parts of my personality, is definitely one of the weirdest parts for me.
Yeah. I had a moment where one of my students at the end of class came up to me and they asked, when is the third book coming out? And I was like, the Hamartia cycle? And they said, yeah, because I've read the first one, I'm going to read the second one. And then, you know, I just wanted to know when the third one was coming out. And I was like, oh my god, I just don't quite know how to deal with this. And then
I was like, honey, we all want to know that, but do not put her off when she's writing Kestrel, okay?
But then I came into the class the following week and they were reading Blood of the Delphi in front of me. And it was so, like, it was wonderful, but it was so strange. And I agree that one of the strangest things about being published is occasionally seeing people who I don't know talking about the books. You know, people who I have no association with, drawing pictures, writing fan fiction, you know, doing all of these kinds of things, just, you know, recommending it. It literally just makes my heart explode. And yeah, I get the same thing where I suddenly like, oh god, but it isn't that good. I mean, I look back at The Sons of Thestian and I was like, whoo, yeah, things have changed. So yeah.
I think the thing is as well, because writing's incredibly personal. Yeah. And yet it's a personal thing you do and then cast out into the world and it's no longer your thing anymore. It becomes the property of anyone who gets hold of your book.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's one of the most wonderful things about being published, and also one of the most bizarre things. I think the other thing is that every now and again I do forget that I am actually published. Like, I sort of...
Yeah.
It's just suddenly this reminder of, oh no, wait, I am actually a published author. That is a thing that I have done. And again, I think imposter syndrome really does play into that. So yeah.
Yes, definitely.
So there we go. These are our frequently asked questions. We would love to hear from you guys if you've had different experiences, or if there's a question here that we haven't answered that you'd really, really like to know. Don't worry, we're open to all questions. We would really love to hear from you. Remember, you can get in touch with us via our Facebook, our Twitter, or our Tumblr, and you can get in touch with us both individually or via the Dissecting Dragons pages. So yeah, leave us a comment, let us know, were you expecting our answers, have you learned anything, and would you like to know more? For now, before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe that you have one for us.
Yes, I've spoken probably at length about Holly Black's books, and you know, I'm talking about fairies here, so it's my turn to bung a quid in the FDA. She wrote the modern fairy tales and also The Folk of the Air, which is her most recent trilogy, mm-hmm. which shows probably one of the best enemies to lovers type progressive romantic arcs that I've seen, and does quite a lot of other stuff as well, which, you know, I won't go into, but basically, this book is a novella. It's beautifully illustrated, and it's clearly done with the idea of, you know, it's coming out at Christmas, fans will love mm-hmm. this. And it's called How the King of Elfheim Learned to Hate Stories. And if you're a bit of a folklorist, or, you know, you like looking at fairy tales, this takes a sort of classic fairy tale type structure and gives it a twist, mm-hmm. or three. And it's really beautifully done, and it's from the perspective of the male protagonist in, you know, the Folk of the Air series. Mm-hmm. The one who starts off as a bully and actually turns out to not be the terrible villain that he's making himself out to be. So, no spoilers, but it was absolutely charming, and I just sort of went from beginning to end.
Fantastic.
Really, really good book.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much. And on that note, guys, we'll say thank you very much for listening. We hope you're all keeping healthy and safe. And we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.